Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
What is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
I'm not sure if you guys are aware of this, but there's some very good stuff happening on the World Service at the moment, and it's not just confined to sport. The conversation you're about to hear today concerns one of the most shameful scandals in Irish history, the rawness and pain of which is still being felt today. This one originally went out last Friday to our World Service members. It probably wasn't exactly what they were expecting to hear on a Friday podcast going into a weekend when Liverpool and Man United were about to play each other at the top of the Premier League. But the reaction, I must say, was incredible, really. There was a lot of anger at what was laid out in here, a lot of sadness on behalf of all the women and children who were subjected to the cruelty of mother and baby homes over many decades. And there was a huge amount of warmth and respect shown towards Fionn Davenport for telling his story with such openness and eloquence. Now, it's because of the support of our members that we can go off script like this and do things entirely outside sport, if that's what we feel we want to do, because we know that they continue to back us whatever we do. And to be honest, it's the same with the Where is George Gibney podcast that I know many of you listen to. The support of our members gave us the time and the space needed to produce something like that. And I think you can see the results. That series is now making massive inroads in the US, with the New York Times publishing a story about how Gardaí are investigating accusations that Gibney sexually abused two swimmers who came forward after hearing the podcast about him. So all we're asking for really at this point is just have a quick think. If you'd like to support this kind of work, membership costs just €5 a month plus VAT. That VAT rate is dependent on whereabouts in the world you're listening from. If you're in a position to pledge that to us, then please do consider doing it. There's no minimum contract or anything like that. You can sign up today and finish up tomorrow if you want. I mean, that would seem a little extreme. We'd like you to give it a bit more of a crack than that. But essentially, you just have to pay for the first month, and then it's a month by month thing after that. So you can decide at the end of each month whether or not it's something you want to continue with. So why not give it a whirl today? Thanks for your time. Here is the Mother and Baby Homes podcast with myself and Fionn.
And I said, I want to win the league, but I want to win it better. You can understand that, can't you?
Yes.
Good lad.
So he's almost like having a second captain in the team.
Second captain, first captain, whatever.
World Service members, hello and welcome to Friday Second Captain's Podcast. Thank you as always for supporting this thing. You guys are amazing. I like you and I like your style. We're doing something a little bit different for you today, because this week was a momentous one in Irish society, with one of the darkest parts of our history being brought into sharp focus. On Tuesday, the final report of the Mother and Baby Homes Commission of Investigation was published, detailing the cruelty experienced by thousands of women and children at 14 mother and baby homes and 4 county homes across Ireland between 1922 and 1998. And the following day, on Wednesday, the Taoiseach issued a state apology for how these people were treated. Now, for anyone not familiar with the basics, I'm thinking especially of those of you outside Ireland, these homes were religious institutions for unmarried mothers and their children, run by the Catholic Church and the state. The investigation was prompted by the work of the historian Catherine Corliss, who discovered in 2014 that there were no burial records for almost 800 children who died at the Bon Secours mother and baby home in Tuam. Excavations there subsequently found significant quantities of human remains in a disused septic tank. Having already said that all of society was complicit in what happened, Taoiseach Micheál Martin apologised on behalf of the government, the state and its citizens for what he described as the profound generational wrong visited upon Irish mothers and their children who ended up in a mother and baby home or a county home. One of those children happens to be a good friend of ours, the brilliant travel writer and editor Fionn Davenport, and he's with me today to talk to us about his own experience and that of his mother Jane, as well as guiding us through some of the reaction to what has happened over the last few days. Fionn, how are you?
How you doing, Owen?
I'm doing okay. How are you doing? I mean, has this been an emotional week?
Yeah, it's been an exhausting week, I think, would probably be the term that I would use. Exhausting, not shocking, not surprising. There's a sense of just familiarity with it all, and a tired familiarity with it all. That the report, certainly I read the executive summary, the report itself is 3,000 pages long. And in order to even begin reading it, I have to muster up a huge amount of inner reserve that I just don't have this week. So I'm going to digest it over time. And I think it might take me a couple of months to even start getting through it.
Yeah, I can only imagine. But before we get into your own story here, I just want to play a clip. Features some of the phenomenal women who were in the mother and baby homes who were speaking to Liveline on RT recently. Before you hear their voices, you'll first hear the voice of Catherine Connolly. She's an independent TD who gave an emotional and powerful speech to the Dáil and directly to the Taoiseach earlier in the week.
The powers that were was the church, with the politicians playing a subservient role. The absence of records, the appalling mortality rate, it was known at the time. And you're saying here today that we're all responsible. I am not responsible. My family was not responsible. The people I know were not responsible. And those least responsible were those put into the homes. So don't stand here today and expect me to listen to you with patience when you tell us society did that. Society did it. The society composed of the powerful against the powerless.
It's all a bit late down the line. There's a lot of harm, there's a lot of hurt, there's a lot of pain. And to this day, it's still hard to get to the bottom of it all. My parents did everything to keep me at home, and that was not allowed.
I was taken down to old St. Catherine's in Tralee, and when I had her, the following day, the social worker and the sister, that was the nun that was in charge of us, in the institution, came in, and I had to sign over my first daughter, and she was actually adopted from Bedsborough.
Gastroenteritis broke out, and a lot of the mums there hadn't got enough breast milk to feed their babies, and my mother had a lot to feed at least two more, so she acted as wet nurse, and I think for that she got great recognition. Yeah.
What an incredible woman.
An incredible woman, Joe. She's 101 now in February.
I was with him for 7 weeks, Joe, and I was very, very bonded with him. Very bonded. And I absolutely took to being a mother like a duck to water. It was the happiest I've ever been in my life. I wasn't just bonded, I'd say I was welded. I loved him. Bottomlessly.
That's the voice of Anne Toner there at the end, preceded by Elizabeth speaking about her mother, also Caroline Donovan and Mary Fitzgerald. They're all from Liveline on RT this week. Even listening to that, Fionn, I guess, is a powerful reminder of what these women went through.
I think one of the difficult things, but also really important, is that listening to other voices of people who have been affected by experiences in a mother and baby home, whether as the children born there and lost their birth parents, or someone who gave birth in a mother and baby home, is that you realize that this isn't something that happened to me in isolation. And one of the things about being adopted in Ireland is that for most of my life, it was an isolated reality for people like me, in that there wasn't a place or a space for me to go and discuss all of the nuances and the difficulties and the challenges of being adopted. So when you hear these voices and how emotional they are, one, you realize you're part of a much bigger thing. And second of all, you also understand how deeply affecting this was, not just for me or anybody that I personally know who has had direct experience of it, but for so many thousands upon thousands of others spread across the country, alive or dead. And I think that's the thing that really has hit me this week.
Can you tell us a little bit about your own story in this context?
Sure. So my mother, my birth mother, Jane, was 19 when she got pregnant. And in January of 1968, she didn't know where to go. Her family of origin, her own family, were not going to support a girl who had a baby out of wedlock. And she was really, she felt she had two choices. And one of them was to disappear off to England, where she didn't know anybody. Or the alternative was to go to a mother and baby home. So she chose a mother and baby home, and the home she chose was St. Patrick's, then known as Pellettstown on the Navan Road. And I was born there on the 8th of April of that year. And I obviously, I didn't know any of Jane's particular story until many, many years later, or indeed the circumstances of my own birth. But I was born, and within 2 days, Jane changed her mind and wanted to keep me. But she was told by persons unknown who worked in the home that she couldn't, that she had signed a document when she went into the home that gave her permission to give me up for adoption, and therefore she had made her decision, and that was that. And the best thing she could do was just get used to it and move on, because there was no going back now. And so Jane did just that. And it wasn't until many, many, many years later that she discovered that, in fact, that this was a terrible, terrible lie, and that under the terms of the Adoption Act, which was passed in 1952 and only came into law the following year, that mothers who give birth to a child and then want to put them up for adoption have until the baby is 6 months old to make a final decision one way or the other, allowing for the very humane thing that you could actually change your mind. Jane wasn't given that right. So she stayed in the home until July or thereabouts of that year, which is also when I was adopted. And I was adopted through what later became known as CUNAV, is on South Ann Street in Dublin, which is the Catholic Adoption Agency. And now I know you know my parents. So I was adopted by two remarkable people, and Bernard and Fiamma, and raised by them. They then adopted my brother a year and a half later, and 7 years later they adopted a little girl that was my sister. Yeah. So that's more or less the kind of sketchy detail, and that was it. I after I left the home, I had no contact with Jane or anything like that. I didn't even know her name.
But even hearing that here, it's especially heartbreaking, having heard that clip earlier on, the last voice belonging to Anne Toner, who talked about the bond that she had formed. And she had her child for a little longer than your mum had you. It was a number of weeks. But she said, of course I had a bond. Did she say, I was welded to the child, a bottomless love after a number of weeks. So it just goes, just puts it into even more stark contrast that this child, you, were taken away after a couple of days from a woman who had just given birth to you, who wanted to keep you.
And I think it's listening to Anne's voice that brought up, when listening to that clip, and I'm doing my level best not to be overwhelmed by the emotion of it. But it's that sense of, I realized that Jane, I subsequently met Jane. So I was in my mid-30s when we had a reunion. But I can only, listening to Anne, I can only imagine what it must have been like for Jane. And one of the things that's the details of it are interesting, is that from the outset, the girls are put to work. Jane was put to work in the nursery. All the other girls in the home were put to work in the laundry. So one of the shocking things is that you have someone, let's say you're 8.5 months pregnant, and you're 8.5 months pregnant and you're working in a hot laundry. I find that inconceivable. Mm. The idea that no allowance, no succor is given you for the fact that you might be heavily pregnant or might be in any kind of distress, you were there. And all the while, there's this sense that the staff, the nuns who operated these places, are doing you a favor that you're not really entitled to, because you are a sinner who has transgressed the moral code that this society operates under. And as a sinner, you don't deserve anything but the contempt of that society. So the very fact that we are here, we the nuns, taking care of you, you should be grateful to us for that. And that's the attitude that pervaded these places. And when Jane, when I was born, Jane was not allowed to breastfeed me. And when she was allowed to give milk to other babies in the nursery, those other babies did not include me. And so to speak to perhaps Anne's experience, and not just Anne's, but thousands of others, this idea, and it's something that I've looked into for over the years, is this idea of that root that all mothers have with their baby, that that bond, that sense, that mammalian instinct that binds mother and child. If you take that away, the baby is automatically disoriented, all at sea, and is scrambling for a coping mechanism. And when you consider then what happens when you don't have that instinct, is that it's a feeling of mistrust that expresses itself in one of two ways. It's either I'm going to hold on to you so tightly so you don't leave me, or I'm going to not let anybody get too close in case they do. And I can say from my own experience that I've had to grapple that all of my life. And one of the things is that it's something that I didn't come to terms with until I was near 40 years old. Because I think for much of my life, for a variety of reasons, one being what I said earlier, this idea of I had no space to go and talk about any feelings I had that might pertain to being adopted. And as good as my parents were, and as wonderfully liberal and open-minded and were happy to discuss anything, they also didn't know. They didn't know what it must feel like. So there's that. And also there's a sense that I refuse to be marked by something that happened to me that I had no control over. So I felt, you know what, no matter what happens to me, the fact that I'm adopted, the fact that I didn't have a bond with my birth mother, I'm not going to let these things affect me. But affect me they did. And I think, obviously, the issues that adopted children face are not exclusive to adopted children. You don't have to be an adopted child to have difficulties trusting people. But my understanding is from years of therapy and also reading about this is that adopted children have a much higher propensity to deal with these things or have to deal with these things than children who weren't.
That's really fascinating. So you actually railed against that for a long time. You didn't accept for most of your life that this
no.
bizarre yeah. beginning had any real impact, but in recent years you've come to accept that it has.
But there's a sense that, like, you know, I make my own life, and you know, and also there's a confusion at the root of it as well, is that because my parents are good people, they gave me a good life, they gave me a good education, I wanted for nothing. My father traveled because of his work, my mother is Italian, I grew up speaking languages, I grew up blessed in so many ways. So even though from early years, from the age of 8 or 9, I started to feel really uncomfortable about, and I couldn't put my finger on it, certainly I looked at the environment that I was growing up in and went, you know what? No, I have been given all these things, so I'm just going to plow on. And I felt that to be the driving force of my character until I was well into my 30s, by which time, ironically or paradoxically, my character had already been pretty much developed. So maybe I could just take the foot off the gas and just kind of relax and just say, right, okay, let's start to interrogate. Let's start to interrogate these things. And it's, you know, I had issues when I was younger with addiction, with alcohol, with substance abuse, that thankfully I was able to deal with many, many years ago. And even though, of course, it's not a given that that all adopted children are going to have to deal with substance abuse issues, because that's clearly not true, it was the case, certainly it was true in my case. And also as well is that studies show that adopted children have a higher propensity to deal with substance abuse or addiction issues than non-adopted children. So do you
draw a link? Is it as simple as there being a direct link between what happened at your birth to later on developing those addictions, do you think?
I think it's a difficult one to answer, Owen, to be honest, because my brother, for instance, doesn't have any of these issues, and nor does my sister. I do, and I would wager that they had a very similar birth to mine. But it did in my case. And whilst I don't draw a direct parallel, it certainly was a contributing factor. And as I said, it wasn't something I didn't admit to myself, or I wasn't able to acknowledge until I was well into my late 30s. I had already met Jane at this stage. And so I started to really interrogate what being an adopted child actually meant. And coupled with that also, there was another layer, and that is guilt, a sense of guilt that here I was looking to find my story of origin when I had a wonderful mother and a wonderful father and brother and a sister and a family and a history and a story. But I was interested in the other story, in the story of where I came from, who my birth mother was, who my birth father was. Until I was 35, I'd never met anybody that I bore any resemblance to. And when I would go for physicals, or I'd go to the doctor and the doctor would say, well, do you have any hereditary illnesses? And I'm like, I have no idea. I don't know. I could never answer that question until I was into my late 30s. And there was no mechanism for me to find these things out. None. Yeah.
I mean, you say that, so how, I don't know, I've obviously never done an interview like this before, so I don't even know if it's an appropriate question to ask how you did go about finding it out, how you actually did connect with your birth mother.
Okay, no, oh my God, it's such an important part of it. So when I was 19, I went through a rush of wanting to find information out. So I went into CUNAV, which is now gone on South Ann Street. And I asked and I made a request and I said, look, I'm obviously over 18 now, so I can. And I was given virtually no information. And so I went away, and I went away forlorn and a little just, well, but then again, not surprised. You know, I wasn't expecting much. There was certainly that pattern of silence existed over everything. Nobody was telling anybody anything. And the unspoken thing was like, move on with your life, you know? You're a happy boy, just move on. So I did the best I could and I did. When I was 35, a letter found its way to me from CUNAV asking me to contact them. So I did, and they said that my birth mother had been looking for information about me, and if they wanted my permission to let her know that I was interested or not, which is perfectly reasonable. And of course, well, I thought about it for 5 seconds and said, yes, I am interested. So we exchanged letters, very much under CUNAV's direction. So we exchanged letters for a number of months and just gave out basic information about ourselves. And then we met. And the first meeting was very much in keeping with my character, where I downplay big things, even though, like, I'm smoking like a trooper, I'm sweating, I'm speaking at 1,000 miles an hour. And my girlfriend at the time, who had been with me and was walking around town, said that, like, you're walking around like you're like a crazy man. And, you know, chain smoking and talking frenetically and making stupid jokes. And when I went in and I was introduced to this woman, Jane, and my first thought was like, oh, you don't look as much like me as I thought you would. And we talked stiffly, politely, and we agreed then that we would meet again. And over the next couple of years, we would meet every 2 weeks or so in a restaurant in town. And we would just, and we made a promise to each other. Well, she made a promise to me. She goes, you can ask me any question you want and I will answer it to the best of my
ability. Okay, that was another thing. Yeah, I didn't, because you have talked about some of what she went through, but I wanted to know how open she was with that information. You obviously got into deep enough conversations at some point.
Oddly enough, not at first. And I thought, it goes to show you the trauma and shock of it all. Was that I would come away from meetings with her and berate myself for not asking the question that I'd really wanted to ask, or having forgotten the question, or not knowing, or and it took a number of years before I found out what actually happened in the home. And one of the things about Jane was that Jane, in all the years since, has always been incredibly respectful of the fact that I was adopted into another family, and that I have a mother and I have a father and I have a whole story. And she has always made it very clear that, look, and this frankly has always made me quite sad, is that she said, look, I'm willing to take whatever you can give me, and that's okay with me. And so she's always been incredibly respectful of my process around this. And we kind of went our separate ways, and not deliberately. I realized after maybe 2 years that all this was a bit too much for me. So I kind of fell out of touch with her for about 5 years. And then picked up again for no reason that I can particularly remember. But it's been a stop start, a hesitant. I wrote a piece about this not so long ago, and in it I said that, you know, all reunions are difficult, even the easy ones. And mine was very easy. But even in being that way, it was remarkably difficult and challenging, for, I imagine, for both of us. But, you know, thankfully now, it's been 17-odd years since we've met. Like, for instance, I rang her this week and just to make sure that she was okay. And we talked a little about her reaction to the home, to the news, rather. And she called me love. She went, thank you so much for calling, love. And I think that might be the first time she ever said that. And that was lovely. That was amazing. Really, really nice.
So it's still like a developing relationship.
It's a developing relationship, but it's also determined by the fact that I'm 52 years old. She's 72. Mm. And, you know, we live in different countries and we are where we are. And it's not that... I mean, I hope to maintain a relationship with her for the rest of her life, if not mine. But yeah, it's always a bit distant. Mm. And I think it has to remain so, certainly for me.
And it has to remain so. Why? Why can't you allow yourself at this point to get a little closer?
I think in part because of ambivalent feelings I have around my mother, a sense that I think one of the things that I remember it was said to me when I was a child was that you shouldn't ask too many questions, not by my parents, mind you, by others. You shouldn't ask too many questions about your birth mother because it'll just hurt your mother's feelings. And I have to be honest, 45 years on or whatever it is I find it difficult to shed that entirely. I mean, I'm a grown man, I have agency, and I appreciate that I can maintain this relationship or keep the two relationships entirely separate. But there is no doubt that emotionally, that latent feeling of guilt can still kind of bleed into me.
Okay, yeah. And I mean, I don't know if it plays into it, but your dad died relatively recently, a couple of years ago as well. And you mentioned before that I know I spent literally feeling probably my favorite ever day on holiday at your folks' place in Italy. I think it's where your mum grew up.
Still, my mother still talks about it. My father. Oh,
but I didn't realize your father is this, like, your father was this amazing diplomat, very hugely well respected, a huge figure. I didn't realize he was also a massive football man. He was a brilliant footballer back in the, that always gets more respect from me. I know I've gotten a bit of a tangent here, Fionn, but it just highlights the great relationship you had with him and you have with your mother.
And it's funny because when I met Jane first, I told my mother, and my mother was quiet about it. I mean, respectful and quiet, but my father's attitude was just like, well, you got to do what you got to do. I mean, absolutely, you know, you go right ahead. So the blowback came nothing from my mother and father, but more from my own tangled psyche and my own confused emotions about this. And I think that in the years where I've had occasion to meet other adopted children, this is not an unfamiliar landscape, that many, if not the majority of adopted children have these tangled, confusing, conflicting psychological battles in relation to, because one of the things that adopted children balk at, whether they realize it or not, is that, oh, well, you know, you got a better life. It was like, no, I don't know that I got a better life. I got a different life. Mm. Like, I don't know. And particularly now, with the fact that, of course, I am grateful for the life that I have had, but I'm also angry for the life Jane didn't have.
Yeah.
Because of this lie. Jane was denied a life with her son because of nasty bureaucracy, informed by a really nasty ideology. But, you know, and I cannot reconcile that. And the report doesn't help me reconcile it. The words of Antishuk don't help me reconcile it. Nor does, you know, nor am I expecting Antishuk to do that. But this is the difficulty. And it's this tangled psychological web that most adopted children have to deal with.
But you know what's mad? And I've heard you describe yourself in the past as one of the lucky ones. And I think people understand why. Sure. in the way you describe your love for the family that brought you up. And yet you're going through, have gone through and continue to go through all this stuff in your head. And you're one of the lucky ones. It just makes me, it makes me even more aware of the lot of the unlucky ones.
That's absolutely true. I do consider myself one of the lucky ones. And because no matter what, is that I have a stable history to fall back on when I am in turmoil or any kind of emotional torment about any of this. But it's absolutely true. I've met people who have had horrid experiences, even when trying to trace birth parents that couldn't be traced. I met a man who was 70 years old and didn't find out that he had been adopted until the year before. Adoption stories, there's a million of them, and they're not all the same, but they have things in common, obviously. And I think it is a really, really difficult thing. And I think that this report, and particularly the hot takes that, you know, it's invariably, this is a big, big, big story, and there are so many hot takes being heard. And I'm a member of a group of both children born in St. Patrick's and mothers who gave birth in St. Patrick's on the Navan Road. And reading the thread, what is absolutely clear to me is that nobody feels satisfied. Nobody feels happy about this. Nobody feels relieved. Nobody feels the sense of, oh, finally, we've gotten that thing that we've been yearning for all of our lives. Mm. This is an important marker. It's an important step. There are huge problems with the report, but the report is but one step on this road, and I think it'll be quite a while before we can confidently say that it was all for the good.
How did Jane feel about all of it, about everything, all the publicity and everything this week?
I think it brings back very sad memories for her. I think it there's a terrible sadness when I spoke to her. I don't think she would mind me if I told you that she's chain smoking like a trooper. And I'm like, what do you do? Like, and she's like, oh, look, it's the one thing that gives me comfort. I think it's been difficult for her. I think it's been very, very challenging. I think the idea that it brings back and makes a memory fresh of what it must have been like for her to say goodbye to me, to deliver me, to be in a home, to be told that, no, you can't keep your baby. I think 52 years later, I think that must be very, very difficult for her to process even now.
What did you make, Fionn, of Micheál Martin saying one hard truth is all of us, one hard truth in all of this is that all of society was complicit in it? He goes on to say, we treated women exceptionally badly. We treated their children exceptionally badly. We had a completely warped attitude to sexuality and intimacy, and young mothers and their sons and daughters were forced to pay a terrible price for that dysfunction.
Yeah, I think it's mealy-mouthed. I don't think it's fair. Actually, that's, I think, the best. I think it's profoundly unfair. The idea that somehow there weren't agents of the state and the church who are directly responsible for this, just, I find absolutely galling. And, you know, and I've seen people suggest that, like, you know, that the church can't dictate morality, that morality belongs to society, that the church is but a mirror that reflects the morality. And I'm like, well, how convenient then that they controlled the education system, had access to government at a cabinet level, and had literally a bully pulpit in every single parish of the country. I find that galling that the church aren't held more responsible. I find it galling that agencies of the state that had an a direct hand and act and part in the setting up of these homes, because these homes were established because they didn't know what to do with the girls. The girls who got pregnant out of wedlock were to be thrown away. And these homes were set up for them to be thrown into. And for anyone to suggest otherwise, I think, is doing a disservice both to the 56,000 women that went into the homes, to the 57,000 children that were born in the homes, including the 9,000 children who died in those homes, and to all of the people connected with the trauma of the mother and baby home experience. Because, and this is something, it's like, it's not just, and we can all instinctively understand that Catholic morality says that, well, getting pregnant out of wedlock is a sin, and as a sinner, you are deserving of public rebuke. But in Ireland, the pregnant girl was not just a sinner. She carried, they passed the seed of their transgression onto their illegitimate progeny. And in so doing, they condemned their children to a life of depravity. And that was the teaching. It's an extra layer. It's not just like, oh, you got pregnant. Oh, that's not good. That's a sin. It's the level of odium directed at these girls is absolutely. And to say, absolutely, was society complicit in the maintenance of this? Absolutely. In the way that all of us are influenced by the moral forces that dominate our young lives into our adolescence. And I'll give you an example. My mother is Italian. She moved to Dublin in 1964 from Catholic Italy. My grandmother is a Catholic. She went to Mass regularly. When my mother moved to Dublin, I asked her this question yesterday. I said to her, it's like, what impression did Catholic Dublin, never mind some small Boreen in West Kerry, I mean Dublin, the most cosmopolitan city in the state, what impression did Catholic Dublin make on you? And she went, Fiona, it was like going back to the 12th century. You know, this obsession with religion, with piety, this obsession that the priest had this oversized role in every community. Everybody was in awe. And she says, and I said, was it not like that in Italy? And she goes, no. I mean, Catholicism, of course, Italy is a Catholic country, but it didn't have that overbearing presence in the way that it did in Dublin at the time. And I find that, and so when Micheál Martin says things like, you know, ah, sure, everybody is to blame, then in so doing, he's saying nobody is to blame. Mm. And I'm sorry, but there are people, agencies that are definitely to blame.
There was one of the points that has angered a lot of people, and a lot of survivors are angry, it seems, with quite a few strands of the report and the sort of overall narrative. But one of the big things that people have kind of hung on to is this part that says, where is it here? Yeah, there's no evidence that women, this is from the report's findings. I think you already know where I'm going with it. There's no evidence that women were forced to enter mother and baby homes by the church or state authorities. What do you think of that?
No, they didn't put a gun to the girl's head and go, into that home you go. But that is, again, mealy-mouthed and a form of just ridiculous logic. And this is just, it's semantics of the worst kind. Of course the girls had a choice, but it was a Hobson's choice. They had a choice of being isolated, cast out of society altogether, or giving birth in a home, giving that baby up, and then retaking their place, head bowed and sorrowful for the sin that they committed, back into society. That's the choice they were given. And the other alternative, as it was with Jane and many countless others, was you could go away. You could go to England. You could go to another country. So you could leave your home, your family, your friends, your work, whatever it is. So I don't understand this idea of, like, there is no evidence that women weren't forced. Is that they were forced. It mightn't have been at the point of a gun, but perhaps it was even worse. It was at the point of being socially outcast. And that often is a far, far more frightening thing than, you know, than a physical threat.
You said earlier that you had difficulty when you first went looking for records and so on. And this is a kind of a hot topic now.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's talk of legislation being brought in. There's always the there's the issue, of course, that the birth mother might not want to be found, and so it's balancing their privacy, their wishes for privacy, with the right of the children to information about themselves, about their life, about their own identity. Do you empathise with those people, with the many people who don't really, they have virtually no official records of their early lives?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, one of the things about the Commission of Inquiry, and it is worth pointing out that the 2004 law that guarantees anonymity to anybody who gives evidence to the Commission was obviously applied during this one, so that anybody who seeks to remain anonymous has the legal right to remain anonymous. I mean, two things I'll say about this. One is that that law was passed for commissions of inquiry into financial irregularities, for whistleblowers and the like. It was to protect people like that. However, absolutely, there is no doubt that there are people who gave evidence to this commission who wish to remain anonymous. And not one, not Maeve O'Rourke, not anybody who is advocating on behalf of survivor rights to access information about themselves is suggesting otherwise. The thing that I find distressing still today, I mean, before Christmas, there was the whole thing that the database, which basically is the bibliography, if you will, of the commission's investigation, had to be put beyond use for 30 years so that we wouldn't be able to interrogate what that database had. That's obviously difficult. It's difficult because it means that when it comes down to determining who exactly is to blame for, who is to blame for Jane being lied to? Who is to blame for the thousands of children who died? And where there was an infant mortality rate of, say, around 15%, where the national mortality rate was around 4%. Who is to blame for those things? So it makes it difficult to investigate that. But more to the point, if I want to access the records of my birth in St. Patrick's, I am not free to access those records, as is the right of you to access your birth records, of your wife, or indeed of your son, if he comes of age and says, you know, I want to find out. You all have, I don't have that right. So I have to go to TUSLA and ask them, or I have to go to the Department of Social Work, and then it'll be up to a social worker to determine whether I am entitled to have those records. And I find that, and given the fact that I've spent my life not being able to find out basic information about myself, I find the idea that somehow this is still not possible for me, this is incredibly difficult for me to reconcile.
It sounds like we hear this phrase a lot now about being re-traumatized. It sounds like there's an element of that, that if not re-traumatized, it's a continuous kind of trauma, if that's the right word.
You like to think that if you narrow your eyes and narrow your ears, the winds of change have absolutely blown. There is no doubt that this commission of inquiry is a welcome thing, that when Catherine Zappone set it up, it was a remarkable thing, and it filled so many survivors with hope that they're not just their stories would be told, but that the wrongs done unto them would be exposed and given the chance to be righted. And I think that that's all that the survivors want. But then when you hear things like on Taoiseach saying, well, you know, it was all society. And I have no doubt that Micheál Martin read parts of the report over the weekend and was deeply affected by it. You know, he's a human being. I can't imagine he wouldn't be. But, I mean, the only question, I'm not a legal expert and I'm certainly not close to anybody in government. So my question is this, are these roadblocks that are being put in the way, are they, for what reason are they there? Are they there so that the government doesn't avoid a giant financial penalty? Is that if survivors decide to sue for compensation and they will need evidence, for that. And if they're not allowed access the full body of evidence that pertains to their own individual stories, will they then be impeded from looking for financial redress? I don't know the answer to that question, but I'd be an idiot if I didn't ask it.
There's one last strand to this I wanted to ask you about. I just wanted to pick up on something you said on Claire Byrne on the radio show the other day. It actually made me kind of uncomfortable in a sense, and that is You were talking, I mean, people talk about this as an historical issue. You know, it obviously ended in the late 1990s, but it hasn't ended, as we've seen. The effects go on to this day. And more than that, you actually compared what happened in the mother and baby homes with direct provision at the moment. Mm. And I say it made me uncomfortable because as a member of society, I'm sitting here thinking, oh, Christ, like I'm in the middle of this. You know, are we going to be talking about something like, is there going to be a report on direct provision in 50 years where we all have to look at our own roles or looking the other way? What did you mean by making that comparison?
So the Taoiseach yesterday apologized. He offered a state apology for the wrongs done to these 56,000 mothers, 57,000 babies, everybody who was affected by the mother and baby homes. The vast majority, the overwhelming majority of these women were vulnerable and marginalized. They were rendered vulnerable by the fact that they got pregnant out of wedlock, and they were therefore marginalized or othered. They were othered. And by othering, I just mean is that they risked being cast out of society, their families, their parish, their community, whatever way you want to call it. So when you make an apology for the sins, for the ills done to these people, for the apology to have any weight whatsoever, it has to come with a commitment that we will never do that again to the vulnerable and to the marginalized, that we are today a caring society that embraces the vulnerable and the marginalized. And to a large extent, we have made massive inroads in that regard. LGBTQ rights, we have women's right to choose, all of these things, these fights, these huge, important key fights have been won. However, how can you make that apology and stand by it when in society today, there are centres all over Ireland where people are being mistreated, treated in a less than humane way, denied the basic rights that the European Court has dictated they are entitled to. And that is direct provision. So how can we stand up and congratulate ourselves for having gone through this episode and being on the other side of it when there's an entire class of vulnerable, marginalised people who are suffering akin to those that were in the mother and baby homes? And that's what I mean. It's not a cheap point to make. I'm not trying to score some kind of political point. I am simply saying is that it's so easy to go, well, thank God we're far more enlightened than we were. But are we though? I mean, we are towards pregnant girls or mothers, but we're not to an entirely different class of people.
Fiona,
and
I think
that's what I meant.
Yeah, there's a bit of food for thought there for people, I think, as there was throughout that conversation. Listen, it's a very different podcast to what we normally do. Very different conversation to what I normally have with you. So it's nice to get the chance to talk about some of that stuff. Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Owen.
That's Fionn Davenport, editor of Ireland's Travel Trade Network. We're going to be back on Monday with our regular football podcast. We'll be talking about Liverpool against Man United. I know if I keep Fionn on any longer, he will try to weigh in on that. So we better wrap this show now. Thanks again. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you on Monday.
That might be, you know, aiming for utopia, but that is the way I am. I'm a little bit stupid regarding this type of thing. I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
Richie,
God.
How are we feeling this morning?
I just watched the goal set to the Titanic music and it really works. Oh, it really, really works. I think this is the most fun we're ever going to have in the podcast.
Let me tell you, you're only getting this because you're a former player of mine and there's no fourth time lucky, let me tell you.
My father thought that, you know, I was a disgrace and embarrassment, didn't allow me to come back home. And this is a 17 years old and you just made the semi-finals at Wimbledon.
Frazier and Ali in another incarnation when they were both young, and I guess I was too.
Reverend Jesse Jackson, you're very welcome to the show.
Well, a few people resist publicly. He cast a light that lit up our pathway.
30 million watched the fight.
What?
Yes, that's true. I was better known in Africa than I was in
Ireland.
It's
unbelievable.
He threw a hair dryer, I think, at David Beckham in the... Is that right?
No.
So I had this weird thing where I was always the same weight as my age.
Holy shit, Kenan Murphy, it's US Murphy. Round of applause for US Murphy. Yes, that's him.
Kehoe's, right? Upstairs at Kehoe's.
Kills everyone, but that's fine.
Oh, my word.
Oh.
Tell us, talk us through that, Steve. I think we know what's happened, but talk us through it.
Oh, just saying. Sig Thorsen is the only...
Oh, my God.
Fair to say, anybody could have managed those guys?
No, of course not.
It was about 12. Everyone in the city knew about him, but no one had seen him. Look how happy I was. What the fuck happened? No, really. What happened? What happened?
It is not war and death and famine. It's not that at all. It's the opposite of that. It's the persuasion of the world outside of that. That's why sport's important.
The phone is out. That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. They never go home. They never go home, those boys.
The second captain's
world service.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.